Does anybody want to say anything?
Well, I think just on that point that I was making, in all those years, I've never seen the trade union movement in general. There's still, you know, a tremendous amount of individuals play a good part in it, but collectively, I've seen, you know, I remember the 60s and such, like, if there was a dispute. Yeah, we know that the legislation makes it even harder to show solidarity on occasions for fear of the, how was it they describe it, the trade union funds being, what was the word that they used again? Not seconded, but
sequestered.
And I think, as I say, despite all of the good work that many individuals do, try to do, trade unions are they're a defensive mechanism. That's all they are. The defensive mechanism comes into play more when capitalism is on the up. Because as soon as there's any downturn, it becomes even less effective.
John, honest.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things you said, Tosh, about freedom riders, really, and relating that to rail unions and our transport, our rights to have affordable transport as well. And I think future for the labour movement is to see that, in a way, that we've got two huge organisations which affect working class politics in this country. One is trade union movement, and one is the Labour Party. Now, both of them are undergoing fundamental changes because the fight that we're in is more vicious and dirty and nasty than ever been. It's not like the fights in the 60s, which were sort of cleaner. The fights today, when you see accusations of racism, false accusations of racism being levelled in Parliament, try to undermine the Labour Party on the grounds of anti-Semitism, of all things, is absolutely scandalous. And I think that what's happening is that there's the younger generation especially coming through, they don't fit neatly into old-fashioned trade unionism. They don't fit that neatly into the old-fashioned Labour Party. But they do fit in with Jeremy Corbyn, who's connecting, like Tosh did in his speech, Tosh connected up, if you like, the actual organisations in the movement with this rising mood of anger and bitterness and willingness to fight. And so I disagree with you, really. I think that the trade unions are failing where they're failing to see that they have to change. Mm-hmm. I think unions are changing. I think, you know, I mean, obviously I'm not going to sound like I'm totally up to Tosh, but trade union leaders are having to change. Lynn McCluskey is different from other generations of trade union leaders because he understands that in order to secure rights for workers, you have to appeal out to the old community. And I mean, I used to be, I'm retired sort of now, but I used to be a lecturer in further education. And when we had a dispute, the last dispute I was in at the college I worked at, we appealed to students and parents. We didn't just go down and keep it as a trade union issue between us and management. We appealed outwards and made it an issue about education. And I'll tell you what, we lit a fuse, which unfortunately we didn't win, but we could have won. A massive victory. If you want to defend your schools from privatisation, from penalisation, if you want to defend your health service, you can't just have BMA, NUT or teachers, other teachers you're doing. You have to have something which has that social dimension, which has authority. Appeals out into community, because lots and lots of workers at the minute who are either underemployed or unemployed can't have trade union representation. They don't have it. And by, you know, having big events like Demonstrate for Doctors or, you know, fighting back against these slurs against Jeremy Corbyn, I think that's a big issue which we should fight over. I think that radicalises a new generation. I think the prospects of change are nearer than they were in the 60s. For the positive change, I think it is part of our gift to be in a movement where, in a sense, our job is to try and shape and influence the movement. I mean, years ago I used to think, if everybody thought like me, we'd have a revolution tomorrow. But now I think, well, there's lots of people I've never met before, they've probably, on lots of issues, they have better ideas and more knowledge than I have. I don't think that anymore. What I think now is I think, wow, we've got lots of people who are thinking along these lines. I wonder how we can bring it all together and be effective. Mm. I think that's challenging for us. Sorry to go on.
Fred,
do you think it's partly because the change in nature of work in Western Europe and that, with the service sector being so strong now, because the nature of work being precarious, it's quite hard to organise people? Do you think that's a part to play as well?
Well, yeah. There isn't any sort of magic wand, I believe, to solve the issue. I mean, whilst I've been active in the trade union movement for the best part of, say, 50 years, but particularly not the last 10, I have to say, because of the nature of the job, and because of the nature of my job, because I'm in HR, I find it difficult to recruit in the movement, because there is a degree of self-preservation in employment, of course. But those that I do try... persuade to join the union. It's exceptionally difficult.
We had, because I have friends in the IWW, the Struggle Workers of the World, and they were trying to do it, she set up the independent union. They had some success with young service workers, and some of them are quite enthused because they see the TUC unions as like down the road. They think they don't want to be organised and all this, and they've got precarious work. And they do, but they are looking for some kind of like change, and they are looking for a challenge too. They've got some understanding of calculus, stuff about wages system and stuff like that. And they've had some, I mean, it's kind of small victories because they're quite a small union, but obviously they were decimated years ago and they started to reappear. But where there's younger workers being involved, they're quite few, and they have won a few like battles, like small, obviously small battles, but it was quite inspiring some of the stuff they've done. And then wider, I mean, obviously, there's other examples like Unite, the rank and file of Unite and the electricians, when they were fighting the basement, when they were trying to de-skill them, the employers, obviously the people who have been blacklisted, often the same companies. When they had a fight against that 2011, when they were occupying work sites, they were blockading, especially in London, they won the battle there. And then there's other examples, I think, years ago, Melbourne, I think metro workers did work in, were running public surveys. The public sector were running it for nothing then. They had a lockout basically of management. There's been a few kind of wildcats and kind of unofficial actions that have won as well.
Don't we have
a lot of employment? Yeah, in fact, I think Unite Community, I don't know whether some of them intermingle, but the IWW has tried to organise the unemployed and stuff like this as well.
Well, quite a few of them. I mean, I know the GMB does to some extent try to organise the unemployed. And Unite certainly does. I'm not still in Unite. I know it was Unite, I think it was a TNG at the time, truth be told. But when the legislation was evolving out of Europe about holidays, for example, they did it underneath the health and safety issues. That when they I think it was originally 20 days, if I remember. And what did employers do? They immediately included the 8 days bank holiday. Well, quite a number of employers included the 8 days bank holiday in the 20 days. So then, in effect, what was happening, they were giving them 12 days holiday. And then they ate. And it was a TMG. I think a lot of the unions said, but I think the TMG was at the forefront of it, went back to Europe. And managed to get it saying, no, it's 28 days. Much to the employer's disillusionment.
I think coming back to what you were saying about getting people engaged in unions, I think when I've worked outside the NHS, which does have quite a strong union mentality, as soon as I go and work for various different charities, it's almost, you seem like you're a radical, even if you've just joined Unite or Unison. That's just my own personal opinion in certain sectors, which really shocked me when I, always worked before in places like the NHS, where it's just accepted you're going to join a union, big deal. It's hardly militant. But then you remember when I went to work for certain learning disability charities, like, what, you're a part of a union? It's like it's only you who's in the cost. That really shocked me. I was like, to be younger people, but I thought really
even
shocked me that.
given the NHS when I remember working there, and you got a lot of some of the nurses and older nurses were saying to me, like, oh, Unison, why would you want to be part of Unison? That's way too limited and stuff.
You couldn't exactly say Dave Prentice is one of the most
limited.
That's for sure. I'd imagine, Toss, you probably know Rod and Bickerstaff.
Oh, very well, yeah, very well.
Quite well. I haven't seen him for a few years, but yeah, you know, we used to have a few beers in the marketplace and such like.
Remember the days when Rodney used to have too many beers in Mark?
Yes.
I love him. Love him to bits. I do.
Well, Apple was one of his sidekicks at the time as well. You don't hear much about Apple at all now. If you look at the trade union movement here, certainly in Britain, it's substantially concentrated in local government, the NHS, the rail,
education,
yeah. Well, I'm sort of including that in local government education, although some of it's obviously privatised now, for want of a better description. But in the factories and such right now, it doesn't seem to be that. There used to be, there might still be, because as I say, I've not been active for the best part of 10 years now, that you would have people going out specifically, going round businesses, going round places, standing outside, leafleting people to see if they would want to join the union and such. Like, I haven't seen that for years.
United got a lot of organisers doing that, particularly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're doing it. Yeah,
I've
seen it for years.
But I think part of it is that you get a press blackout. Cause I think it was last year or the year before, the Bakers Union actually won a proper private sector strike. You know, they're rare enough, well, apart from trains. But, you know, apart from the specialist media that's... exists to report on trade union disputes. You wouldn't have heard hiding the hair now. Now if one of the bakers had burnt the place down or done anything even remotely naughty as part of it, it would have been all over the place. But a successful strike is not news.
What's left in this specifically just for this building here? There's two causes are really bad. Obviously there's a double threshold in the public sector. Then you've also got the one about the shop steward or the branch secretary, whoever takes responsibility for the picket, has now still got to report to the police. There was one person, I think, because initially they were going to sell everybody else the bomb bans or reports to the police, but I think they still want to try and push it through, so they're going to make somebody responsible report to the police. And of course, well, people, why the hell would you want to be reporting to the police? I mean, they're all the history and everything and all the blacklisting and everything else, isn't it?
It's about fear, isn't it?
It's
trying to make people frightened to stand up.
I think it's also about making it more difficult to organise. Dealing with, from the political party side, dealing with the election commission, to try and organise a political party, you just get met with this faceless, monstrous bureaucracy of doom that you've got to fill in every petty form, and then they just make changes at the drop of a hat. We had our full party name and the World for the Workers on our official logo, and then with no basis in law, and quite arbitrarily, within weeks of to go before an election, they said no more than 6 words on the logo. I can understand why they did that, but the fact that they did it at that time, and that we had no recourse, no matter how much we complained, they didn't go, here's our appeals procedure, it's just, we're a bureaucracy, you've got to do what we say. And it's very much that sort of aspect of control. I mean, the last time we went on strike at my place, because we've got a university campus, we've got multiple entry points, and I sloped off on my own to leaflet what I knew would be a bit of a rat run where people would sneak in. And of course, if you have to report every last picket line to the police, that would become some sort of criminal offence I'd get arrested for. But,
Can I ask you, Toss, why you would believe, though? Why you seem to continue to believe that? When I'm talking about the Labour movement, I'm primarily talking about the Labour Party, with its history of antagonisms towards the trade union movement, and it has. Why you still, if you go back to Barbara Castle and such, when they were looking to introduce legislation then, anti-trade union legislation, the failure to take off the statute with some of the legislative requirements, etc., why you continue to believe that the Labour Party, as opposed to the Labour movement, which you're on it.
Well, I honestly believe that with Corbyn's leadership and the movement it started, the momentum it started, and with people like MacDonald and some of the new MPs that have come in this time, I think there really is a chance that they want to make the Labour Party part of the Labour movement. Not just trade unions, but others like the People's Assembly, other bodies who are fighting. I think they really want to this time. And I know we can say they've failed and they've failed and they've failed. My union was formed in 1880. The vast majority of its history has been very right-wing. You know, when we moved head offices, we found Mason stuff from the Masons and all sorts in there. We had real right-wing leadership over the years. So the same reason we didn't walk away from ASLEF, we tried to change it, is the same reason I say we shouldn't walk away from the Labour Party, because whether we like it or not, that is the nearest thing we've got to a mass party that represents the working class. For all its faults, there's nothing comes close to it. And I spent a lot of my adult life in the Communist Party. But a point I often make, you know, all the time I spent in Communist Party, and I never regret any time I spent there. I learnt how to organise within trade unions. I've got a lot of my education come from the Communist Party. And when one of the guy called John Usher, I don't know if you're from Leeds, aren't you? He's from Leeds Way On.
Yes.
I don't know if you know him. He was one of the senior partners in Thompson's, the trade union lawyers in Leeds. He come to work for ASLEF eventually. But he christened me El Cid, because I was the last communist in Doncaster, and it was El Cid. And after a while, I thought, well, I can't be on my own. I need to be in a party. And I looked at the other parties. The only one I could possibly think of joining was the Labour Party. And after all these years of being able to analyse documents that come out, sit and debate things, I joined the Labour Party. Within days, they got me out delivering leaflets around Wheatley, where I live. Within a day or so of that, I'd be in my local working men's club, in the Wheatley Club, and people, because they'd see me delivering leaflets for the Labour Party, they think I'm something to do with council. And they'd come to me, and they'd be talking about this hedge needs cutting. You can't get past it if you've got a pram or something. The pavement needs doing. And, you know, that's the very stuff that I didn't want to join the Labour Party for. But, you know, I could actually get something done about it. And one of the best MPs from this area I think we ever had was a guy called Colin Bergen. I think his nephew, who's now a new MP, Richard Bergen, is going to make an even better one. And Colin Bergen relates a very similar story. He was in, I think it was the IS, one of the Trotskyist organisations. And he used to be out at meetings all the time. And his mum said to him one day, she says, you know, our Heidi's door, his auntie, a door needs painting. It's in a terrible state. And he says, I can't do aught about that. She says, what? All this time you spend going to these political meetings, you can't even get our Heidi's door painted. And it made him realise, you know, if you're going to do something, sometimes you have to do the little things to win people over. So I don't think there's an option other than the Labour Party right now. And like I say, if we'd have given up on ASLEF, when for the majority of its history it's been very right-wing, I think there's probably three periods of ASLEF's history when it's been on the left of the Labour movement. Now is one of them, and I think probably when Mick Ricks was the General Secretary, and prior to that when Bill Ronksley was keeping Ray Buckton in line, I think we were on the left then. And ASLEF, of course, was formed in 1880 because the forerunner of the NUR was being financed by Bass, the Bass Brewery, the philanthropist, under the understanding that they wouldn't take strike action. So we formed in 1880 to be able to take strike action. But we've been so right-wing, and the Labour Party have, you're right.
You know, in terms of voting, I vote Labour, and I was I'm from a Labour voting family, and I've never going to vote for Tories. Liberals are yellow Tories. I'm a Labour voter. But I do think we've got to be clear that even with Jeremy Corbyn leading a strong Labour Party in Parliament, it's not going to bring the changes we want. And it, you know, we've got to be very, very clear on that. I mean, I support Jeremy Corbyn's leadership 100%. I think he's the best thing that's happened in British politics in my lifetime. I've met him on a few occasions. I'm not friends with him. I can't, you know, claim to be, you know, for him to, if he recognised me in the street, I don't know if he'd remember my name was John. But, you know, he would recognise me because we've been to meetings together. But, you know, I think he's the best thing, absolutely. But the truth of it is that the British state isn't democratic. the democracy that British state allows is part of its keeping control. It's about keeping control. Now, Jeremy Corbyn, and I think he's done everything really, really well since he's been leader of the Labour Party as well, but he is officially, no matter what he thinks about it, he's officially part of the establishment. He is working for Her Majesty the Queen. You know, he's a Privy Councillor, and that's what his role is to support the status quo, to support the Constitution, which he doesn't believe in, right? Now, in terms of, if you look at this political establishment as well, it's not true that it's just the Tories. The political establishment runs through the Labour Party. Tony Blair is a member of the Labour Party. He's part of the political establishment. He's a horrible supporter of imperialism, right? He's a horrible supporter of capitalism. He should be a Tory, I agree with you, Tosh, on that. But he's in the Labour Party, and you can name lots of other people. Like in Doncaster, you'd have to go very far to find people who are completely opposed to Jeremy Corbyn in Doncaster. Now, what that means is that the British state isn't going to say, well, look, Jeremy, you know, you're a great guy, you've led a fantastic movement, you won a landslide election, we're going to make Britain come into line with your values and what you see. You can see the nastiness now. We've already had generals saying that in the event of Corbyn getting any more prominence, that you know, he couldn't be elected because if he did, the British Army would remove him. And a general has already said that. You'll see the royal family coming out of the woodwork and denouncing him. You will see a major, major fight. Now, to me, I think that what I want to do to support Jeremy as the leader, I think there's no backing down. I want Jeremy Corbyn to be the leader. I want him to the Labour Party to grow. I want Corbyn to be elected with a landslide victory in 2020, if not before then, if we can force the Tories into a crisis and have a bigger vote, I'm all for that. But the only way in which we will get any real change is by what you've talked about in what you said.
It's about
working class people in their numbers, trade unions and not trade unions, coming together to fight for the values which Corbyn is about. And therefore, you know, I'm all for voting Labour, but it's a voting exercise. Parliament, British Parliament, is not about delivering socialism. It's a masquerade to actually stop you achieving real.
I don't disagree with any of that, John. I think you know me long enough to know that I don't. But what I will say is, when Miliband was the leader of the Labour Party, and that was actually quite a progressive step for the Labour Party.
I agree.
To get Miliband, the wrong brother, elected. It was quite a progressive step, I mean. And that led some of the way to get Corbyn elected. But when Miliband was the leader of the Labour Party, it took action on the streets to make it safe for him to say we're going to abolish the bedroom tax. It took action on the streets to make it safe for him to say we're not going to vote to bomb Syria. Now, I think the difference here, a qualitative difference, is it's Corbyn's campaign and the momentum brought up by Corbyn's campaign that's given people the confidence to get out on the street in a lot of places. And we need all them fronts together. All them fronts have to fight and come together. And we will change society, but we need to be strong in Parliament and out of Parliament. Because that's my
opinion. Again, today, though, but with respect, you know, and the last meeting, hardly hear anything from you, and really in any shape or form, that you're going to change the fundamental basis of what society is about. Nothing. I really don't. I really don't hear it at all. That's not to doubt your sincerity or your sincerity in it, but I hear nothing that you're going to change capitalism.
From the Labour
Party? Yeah, from any perspective. I hear nothing you're going to change it from what we in the Socialist Party want. It's a worldwide system based upon common ownership, democratic control, and a world without money. Which all buying and selling doesn't exist. Production solely for use. Sorry, but.
During the election, people would ask me, why are you standing against Jeremy Corbyn? And I probably will stand against him again, but it won't be half as much fun because he won't be there. Because he withstood my taunts with the security of someone knowing he was going to get 60% of the vote and could carefully ignore me. But people would ask, why are you standing against him? And I would say, well, it's because, as Tony Benn said, the Labour Party is not and never has been a socialist party. And that was the bit, and that's still the case, as you say, that he's had to, no matter what his personal views are, he's still having now to, quite rightly, democratically tour the party line on various issues, and take the party, the wider party, not necessarily the parliamentary party, with him as far as he can go. So that's why he's having to tack quite considerably on Trident. But we don't know how that's going to end. But that's he might not be able to get what he wants there. But I think even more, it's one of our late members published a book, and he adapted Stan Parker. I don't know if you ever met him. He adapted the kind of like the change management philosophies that you see, and they talk about these five stages of change management, which are very like the five stages of grief, apparently. And you start with your blue sky thinkers, early adopters, early majority, late majority, obstinate resistors. That's the kind of like the five. Yeah, I have been in those management training courses, bloody hell. But there is this Labour movement that has got the vast majority of people in it. And I think that the role of the Socialist Party is someone has to be standing around, obstinately saying, pointing the direction, going this way, blue sky thinking. Early, we're ahead. We're not going to try and take over. We're not going to manipulate. We're just standing still, going, this is our opinion. We need to change and do this and be clear about it. Because I think that one of the worst things about certainly, historically groups trying to join and work within the Labour Party, and the very sort of like parish pump issue that Tosh was talking about, is that you can get lost in them quite quickly, and people think that you stand for the welfare state, that you stand for cleaning up the potholes in the roads, and that they can't say the word. They're so, yes, it's the potholes in the roads are important, no two ways about it, but I have been standing as a councillor going, here I am, I'm trying to have a global socialist revolution, and you're asking me about the potholes in the bloody back end of Clapham North. That aside, because the Liberal Democrats do that, the Greens have tried to do that, the UKIP have tried to do this, we can. In fact, there was a web blog called Glum Councillors, where they'll get pictures up for online of various councillors pointing at potholes that they'd published in their local free sheets, and it's that it's from all parties, because each of them goes, I found a pothole, I did something about it. And important though they are, I think there is this issue that someone needs to stand up. Any movement that's not clear about where it wants to go will eventually find itself going back on the merry-go-round to do it all again.
You see, I think that blue sky thinking is actually in a section of the Labour Party.
No.
I do, honestly. And I mean, I'm not a Labour Party member, right? I'm a trot. But the thing is, when Jeremy came speaking in the Labour Club here, he said lots of things which, I agree with everything he said, but he said some things in particular which I thought was so good. And I think about mental health.
Hmm?
I think it was an absolute revelation to hear somebody being honest about the crisis in mental health and sticking up for victims of sight. That was tremendous. But let me say one thing, if I can give one Atlantic bit which caught my attention. And he said, we produced a document about the environment and about green energy and all this kind of stuff, fracking. I thought it was really good. So what we did was we gave it to these young green activists and said, what do you think of it? Do you know, they tore it in pieces, they shot lots of it. And he said, I'm glad that they did. What he did was, he didn't defend it on this horrible kind of party line of, I've said it, therefore it must be true. He said, I thought we had a good document. The truth of it is, when the activists got hold of it and looked at it, they made it better. Well, this comes back to railways, Tom. Mm. Doesn't it? I can stand there and say, I've got this fantastic transport policy. If it hasn't been worked out with workers in the industry, not just trains, but everything else, then is it a policy which is going to stand the test of is it going to get the approval? It's much better to have that blue sky thinking coming in from working class people. And I think that that's where we're in at the moment. Junior doctors are saying, I don't want to run the health service, but I know it can be run badly, and I know it can be run well. And I've got a voice, and my professional opinion, teachers are the same. Train drivers are the same. That blue sky thinking is there. That creative energy to make the world a better place, I think, is out there on the streets. And it comes back to freedom riders and all that. It comes back to ordinary people active enough to do something about it. And then people like yourself, not jumping to any of it and saying, right, I'll lead it, but saying, right, I'll contribute to it. I'll come to your meeting at Meadowhall, I'll make a contribution. I'll do what I can. Do you know what I mean? I think that's the future for us, is when we come together in a modest kind of way and say, look, you know, I have some ideas, I have some knowledge, I care about this a lot, I want to do a little bit. And I think that is how we're doing it. And to the extent that Corbyn's going to be successful, is, in my view, if Corbyn's Labour Party, other than Tony Blair's Labour Party, because there are two Labour parties, if Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party is fed by the movements that are out there now, and if he relates to those movements, I think he's a surefire winner. I think if those movements switch off and it gets into an internal party dispute, as you saw with John Mann attacking Livingstone the other day, if that kind of politics dominates, then there's a chance Jeremy could lose and the movements are going to lose. So I think to keep the movements going, we have to understand that Corbyn is the best thing for us for a long, long time. We have to keep him in place. And also, I assume Jeremy knows this just as well as I'm saying it, that for him to survive, he depends on the movements too.
That's right.
There's a symbiotic relationship.
I think that the very minimum that's going to come out of it is, because the campaign group was moribund, you know, and the left MPs associated with, you know, actually outside and avowed left were dwindling down to about 12 or 11. I mean, there might have been a wider circuit. But even if Corbyn falls, there'll be some people whose copybook is sufficiently blotted now, you know, that they've been part of the inner circle or that they've been sufficiently supportive of him, that 10, 20 years down the line, they'll still be seen as far-left Labour MPs. And, you know, that even if the Blairites or the Labour right come back to power, they will still have to negotiate with this faction. I mean, as a bare faction analysis of how the Labour Party works, his, you know, the minimum is that the left faction will survive for another day. They're not being wiped out and turned into the SDP just yet, which was Blair's aim, was to make the Labour Party the SDP. So that they'll be around for some while to come.
Sure. No, I think there's another front we have to be really thankful for Corbyn coming along and his campaign. And he had to be talked into standing, you know. I mean, he wasn't there. It took a long time for him to join the race for leader. Because when we first met as a national body, we couldn't nominate a leader. We couldn't choose the tallest at Seven Dwarfs amongst them. When Jeremy Corbyn threw his hat in the ring, we met again and we unanimously nominated the Fourth Trade Union to give him a supporting nomination. But the most important thing, I think, what John touched on earlier, is that what we're seeing is, with Corbyn, there's a movement of young people, particularly out there, who are fed up, don't want to see the same politics going on that's been going on. Unfortunately, it's Corbyn who's come and grabbed their attention. And I think this is happening worldwide, and if you look at America with Trump, Donald Trump, it frightens me to death. Moving away from normal politics, but from a very different part of political spectrum. We've got Bernie Sanders in America as well, but Trump is one that frightens me to death. Now, fortunately, I mean, I think Corbyn, and Corbyn coming at the time he come, I think that was the biggest damage we could do to UKIP. I think that stopped a lot of working class people who are disillusioned turning to UKIP. I think we've gone a good way there. And I don't know, one of the things I think was Freddie talked about, the trade unions just being a defensive mechanism and we're not out there. Well, I'm not trying to shift blame for that, but we are a craft union. We only organise train drivers, nothing else. There's nearly 19,000 of us, and that's it. We're a very small union. We have 97% membership density, though, and we organise well. And every one of our members, and I'm not exaggerating, will know one of our 8 EC members, one of our 8 regional officers, or one of our 2 national officers. They will know them, not just be able to point them out or know the name. They will have met us and know us. And I think perhaps that's the problem with trade union movement, how big the unions have got and almost become like TUCs in the self. And I don't know, I'm not going to be like a missionary telling somebody what's best for them. But a thing we maybe should be looking at is maybe they should have real autonomous sections in them big unions, so they're more identifiable with the members of work and know their working conditions and terms and conditions to bring it to the fore. It's just one of my thoughts. You know,
well, Unison's like that, of course, sometimes, isn't it? If you look at Unison, Unison organises in the NHS, organises in the local government, organises in the voluntary sector, organises in the NHS, and the sort of collective is unison. They all have their separate conferences, etc. And I know, as you know, the purpose of today's is was about the trade union bill and such like. But you know, I mean, I look back again because we're talking about the later part to some extent, and years gone by when Dennis Skinner first came along and he was the firebrand, etc. And Eric Heffer was the firebrand. Tony Benn was the firebrand. They all came and went, and you're talking the same way about Jeremy Corbyn. You know, Jeremy Corbyn for me doesn't stand for socialism though. He's standing for trying to reorganise capitalism as he sees in the interest of the working class. And we, with certainly the Socialist Party, don't believe it can be reorganised in the interests of the working class, because capitalism is worldwide. You can't just have the sort of socialist values in Britain or in France or in Germany or Africa, wherever it might be. And it's the international nature of capitalism that needs to be addressed. Not I think you described it yourself earlier, on the sort of little Englander bit about, you know, the Brexit and such like. These are all, for me, just pie in the sky. It really is. It's absolute pie in the sky, whether you're in Europe or out of Europe. The market system will still exist. And that's a fact. And until you get rid of that, the buying and selling, you'll still have your rich and your poor and your private property, where one individual can own 300,000-400,000 acres of land and such like. The Labour Party aren't addressing the fundamental problems what capitalism is really about. They're trying to use stick and bastards. And that's no disrespect to any of the intentions, but I just don't see it working. I genuinely do not see it working.